So we're recording now on the 59th day to the war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza. A lot has been happening since October 7th, after this horrible, I would say, really horrific Hamas attack, where he massacred more than 1,400 people in Israel. Majority of them are Jews, Israeli Jews. But a lot of them are actually Israeli citizens who are minorities, Arabs, Bedouins, Druze, and also a lot of foreigners. And so far, I would say that military-wise, it seems that the operation is going quite well for Israel, but it doesn't look like we have anything right on the horizon. In order to speak about what's happening in Israel these days, Israeli politics, a lot is going on, surprisingly. I'm glad to have my friend Jeff Becker here. So Jeff, welcome back to Balagan.
Hey, Kobe, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining me again.
You know, you have me on to talk a lot about Netanyahu and the politics specifically and the polling numbers and the government and the coalition. What we talked about before I joined this call was that you're actually on the ground right now in Israel. You were mentioning that you've been essentially everywhere in the last week or two. You were up north on the border with Lebanon and Nahariya. You were on the border with the Gaza Strip going between a lot of the kibbutzim, which were the villages which were attacked on October 7th. And you've also been in a lot of the anti-government, anti-Netanyahu protests, which are still, you know, gaining a lot of momentum in Tel Aviv. So I really want to start off more on a personal note. What have you been seeing? What's the sentiment like on the ground at these protests? What's the sentiment like among the people you've spoken to in the main conflict areas, which are the Lebanese border and the border with Gaza? So I was wondering if you can elaborate a little bit on that, and then maybe from there we can dig deeper into how that's translating into the political situation.
I gotta say that this visit to Israel is not the most pleasant one I ever had. I felt that I need to be with my people, and I've been touring a lot, journaling a lot, speaking to a lot of people, and getting, you know, what people think about what's happening. And I gotta tell you that just like when we had the judicial overhaul and its backlash, you can definitely say that in many ways you still have those two camps that are aligned, some of them with Netanyahu, and at the moment, the sentiment is against him. But I'll give you the best example. When I've been to Nahariya, Nahariya borders around about 6 miles from Lebanon. If you go up north, then it's already closed border. I mean, it's an, military doesn't provide access to Rosh HaNikra, if you ever been there, by the way, a beautiful area. You can also learn a lot about the history of the Middle East from the Turks area, the British and the French mandate. But starting from Rosh HaNikra and all of the kibbutzim and moshavim that are actually bordering with Lebanon are evacuated. They are almost abandoned, with only a minority of people still staying in their homes, most of them elders who doesn't want to move. I spoke to a friend's parents who both told me, listen, we are old enough, okay? We've been here through the first Lebanon war, the second Lebanon war, you know, all of the Katyushas and, you know, all of the history with Lebanon. We didn't move then. We're not going to move now. If Hezbollah is going to take us down, they're going to take us down, but we don't care. But Nahariya itself, the city, was not evacuated. And when you go there, it's like a different world. People are walking on the streets. They still go to their day jobs. By the way, Nahariya is a beautiful city, and it has a potential because they have an amazing beach. But I got to say, it's Ayrat Pituach. It's like, it's a city that has actually, I wouldn't say that it's the poorest people in Israel, but it's definitely not Savion and Tel Aviv. And when you go there and you speak to people, most of them, I will say, don't believe in Israeli politicians in overall. I mean, when you ask them what is their opinion, they will tell you automatically, everybody is corrupted. You know, that's like, That's a great question that a lot of Israelis are saying. I will say on a personal level that it upsets me, because when you're putting, you know, the answer that everybody is corrupted, then you're making your life easier on your choices. And I think that politics, people should take politics a lot more serious and be involved. But when you ask them, so will you change your vote and who you voted for? A lot of them actually voted for the Likud and to the right wing. And, you know, they are fine with the coalition. They don't feel that the things have been changed for them. While if you go to the center of the country, it becomes a lot more complicated. First thing, if we're talking about the families of the people, you know, massacred by Hamas, and the families of the abducted, then the majority of the people within those families are holding the government responsible for October 7th. You're getting more and more evidence, not only from the Tatzpitaniot, the women soldiers who were watching the border, who were always saying, and they were reporting constantly that they see unusual elements around the border for weeks, and nobody took a report seriously. You have an intelligence woman called Vav, okay, you can say her full name, we don't know her full name, and she actually sent three different, you know, letters within the intelligence units for more than a year, telling them that what Hamas is doing will eventually blow us in the face. She can't tell when it's going to happen, but it's definitely going to happen.
Yeah. So there were the specific document you're referring to is the Jericho Wall document, which is one of the documents that came out, which was basically a blueprint that Israeli intelligence had the knowledge of what Hamas was planning to do, and that the threats of it were essentially dismissed by the higher ups in the intelligence community, saying that it was fantasy and Hamas, A, wasn't interested in igniting a war with Israel, and B, also didn't have the capacity to do what they were saying was in the document. But that this has been reported on by Ronan Bergman, who's like a very well-respected journalist, not just in Israel, but in the yes. international community. I'd say sort of going off that, but what you were talking about, we mentioned that in Nahariya, which is in the north on the Lebanon border, people are still really going about their days, but it's a Likud stronghold. It's, to my knowledge, it's always been a Likud stronghold, and that yeah. hasn't really affected.
Well, not exactly always. You know, we there were life before 1977.
That's true. And in recent times, it's in the last couple decades at least, yes, it's been a definitely. Likud stronghold. And you know what you're saying is that basically the people's perception of the government of the coalition of Netanyahu hasn't changed in spite of October 7th. But, you know, the thing that what I want to ask you is that, you know, in the southern kibbutzim by the Gaza border, which felt, you know, took the brunt of the October 7th attacks, the people are more likely to hold Netanyahu and the government responsible. But couldn't you make the argument is that a lot of these kibbutzim that were attacked were very left-wing, peace now kibbutzim. They were always against Netanyahu and they were always against the government. They were always willing to hold the government to account for anything. So could you just make the argument essentially that really not, at least within these areas specifically, that nothing has really changed? It's the same people who support the government, and the same people who don't support the government.
Well, not exactly, by the way, because the people in the kibbutzim, just like the female soldiers, the Tatzpitaniot, I'm sorry, I forgot the English word, you know, for Tatzpitaniot, but Tatzpitaniot are the women that were sitting in the border, watching cameras and, you know, checking for any unusual movement. They were also saying, you know, when we are harvesting, we literally see Hamas terrorists, you know, planning and exercising across the wall. So they have serious complaints to the government. You know, I got to tell you, I never had the chance to be in Israel. Well, actually, I had it once in 2014 when Protective Edge was going, but I forgot about it. I never had the chance to be, you know, like in alarms and when the sirens are going and everybody's running to the shelters. And I must say that beside the fact that it takes off your sense of security level, it's a crazy world that the state of Israel is allowing this thing to happen. The first rocket was fired at Sderot in 2001. You know, a lot of the right-wingers are saying it was because of the disengagement. If we were there, it would have never happened. Well, it's not exactly accurate. The first rocket was fired at Sderot in 2001. Israel made the disengagement in August of 2005. But what happened over these years is that not only that we had the rockets fired, if you remember in 2014, we also had the tunnels. That was the first time that we had the issue with the tunnels that Hamas built. And also starting, 2014, Hamas would fire a lot of balloons that he will throw over the fence to burn the yields of the kibbutzim. Now, Israel did nothing about it. Nothing about it. So that's their complaints, that literally the Israeli government, with its policy, allowed Hamas to grow power. When you think about it, in every conflict that we had since the early 2000s, you know, we had in 2006, right after the disengagement, we had in 2008 an operation, then 2014, 2021, now, you know, it's five different operations. Within every one of them, Hamas actually grew stronger. No, more than that, you know, in recent years, in order to keep Hamas quiet, Israel actually allowed Qatar to deliver cash money to Hamas. And they literally took this money and utilized it. Instead of helping their own people and rebuild Gaza every time, what they mainly did was building an underground country. I got to say that if New York City would have taken them, or if Israel would have taken them to build the tunnels, we could have had, you know, they're talking about more than 500 kilometers of underground tunnels in Gaza Strip. 500 kilometers, give and take, it's like 330 miles of tunnels. That's a lot more than what Israel is building for the light rail in Gush Dan. So their capabilities are insane, but they couldn't have done it if we wouldn't allow it. And that's the main complaint of the kibbutzim. They're saying you literally gave them, you know, the ability to do whatever they want.
It's also interesting, going back to the kibbutzim, the whole relationship between Netanyahu and Hamas can go back as early as the 1990s, if you ask me. I mean, they both did have an interest, you know, tried to turn it into effect in different ways, but of derailing negotiations, of derailing Oslo. I mean, you can argue, you know, from the Palestinian side that Oslo was a flawed agreement, but the fact of the matter was that it was trying to push towards a resolution that would move away from fighting and push at least in the direction of statehood. But both Hamas and Netanyahu at the time had the similar interest in pushing back against it. Hamas, they responded to Oslo with suicide bombings of buses in Israel. Likud and Netanyahu specifically responded to Oslo with basically the incitement against Rabin, who was the prime minister of Israel at the time. And, you know, he and Rabin ended up getting assassinated by a far-right figure. Could make the argument he was inspired by the rhetoric coming from Netanyahu and Likud about how, you know, signing an agreement with Arafat was like the Holocaust. Or, you know, obviously, Kobe, you would know better than me the analogies they were making, but it wasn't pretty. And, you know, we've had basically Netanyahu and Hamas have been in power essentially nonstop for the most part since 2009. So would you make the argument that these two, you know, both Likud, Hamas have had an interest in prolonging the status quo? How would you respond to that?
That you have a valid point. And I will say, by the way, that if you're adding Nasrallah and Hezbollah, it's actually the same. But yes, and by the way, even Netanyahu said it in his own words in 2019, that Hamas is the best way to keep away the Palestinian state dream. Bezalel Smotrich, who is Israel's now minister of finance, Okay, and he's coming from religious Zionism. He's a, you know, right-winger messianic representative. And he literally said, if you don't want a Palestinian state, we need Hamas around. So they knew why they are keeping Hamas, because they knew they can count on Hamas to attack us at one point or another. And yes, definitely both of them, you know, even if they will not call it, you know, partners, you know, partners in crime per se, they both share the same interest of keeping the conflict going. And but I got to say a really important thing. While the Likud was keeping it on a national level, both Hamas and the settlers on our hand, you know, Hamas on one hand and the settlers are on our hand, are making this argument religious. And when you're going to fundamentalism, then you have no way out. When you hear the voices from Israel now, from the right-wing politicians, people like Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and all of the representatives of the settlers are saying that we need to go back to Gush Katif, we need to settle back in Gaza Strip, we need to clear Gaza Strip, we need to transfer the Palestinians. You know, they're giving the best, I would say, materials to the BDS movement. And on the other hand, Hamas, you know, Hamas literally said, you know, we need to kill all the infidels. By the way, it doesn't mean just Jews. And we need to clear the land of Palestine and put the Sharia law. So it becomes a war of the fundamentalists. And it's a very dangerous point for Israel and for the Palestinians themselves also, because majority of the Palestinians are not radical religious. They may hate us, they probably do, but they are not fundamentalists. And if we're going to make them fundamentalists, then both sides are literally doomed, I would say.
So you talk about, you know, at the beginning of this, you talked about how, okay, Israel may be, you know, having some strategically doing pretty well in Gaza, but the overall picture, at least for maybe the next year or two, maybe longer, is that the future looks grim. I'm using your words here. Now that this whole Likud Hamas transactional relationship, whatever you want to call it, understanding, I think is a better word, seems to be over, and that everyone on the Israeli right, you know, who once saw Hamas as a tolerable threat, now sees them as intolerable. Where do you see this going from here? Is mainstream Israeli society, was there a change in direction now? Is there any sort of ultimate goal here? Is the government trying to, you know, bring back the Palestinian Authority into the Gaza Strip? Like, there's a lot of unanswered questions, and I feel like a lot of people would like to know if there's, on the ground in Israel, if there's any talk about what the day after is going to look like. Because honestly, that's more, you know, can be argued more important than like the war itself.
Sadly speaking, Israel didn't really set up an end goal, and it's hard to understand what they really want to achieve. On one hand, Bibi, Benny Gantz, everybody in the government are saying, we're going to eliminate Hamas. But then when you ask them, okay, so what's going to happen in Gaza? Should we bring back the Palestinian Authority? They say, oh, definitely not. But are we going to conquer Gaza and put all of the Gazans under Israeli regime? I mean, are we going to go back to Gaza and be responsible for those 2 million people? Israel doesn't really need it, doesn't really want that. It's definitely against our interest. But you can't tell, because eventually Netanyahu is unwilling to promote the peace, I can't call it even peace process, but any other, you know, detente option. The Americans are actually talking about the Palestinian Authority. You heard Biden and the, you know, Secretary Blinken, who are saying that we need to see the Palestinian Authority is getting in. I think that the best solution for Gaza in the short term is that actually, if we're going to get the Arab worlds involved, we'll give the leadership on that to Saudi Arabia and Egypt. That people need to remember, by the way, Egypt has a border with Gaza. If they want to help the people of Gaza, they can open the border and let them flee towards
Rafah. Yeah, but Kobe, that creates a whole other argument, though. And there's no Arab country that wants to be seen as legitimizing displacement. And I mean, from their end, rightfully so.
Right. But what I'm saying is that people are always complaining about Israel around Gaza. You also, what I meant was that we also need to remember that they have a shared border. And the Egyptians, out of their own interest, because Hamas is aligned with the Muslim Brothers, okay, who are the opposition to Assisi, to the Egyptian president, then he doesn't want anything to do with Gaza and Hamas. But what I wanted to say is that if we're going to propose, you know, the Arab countries take the lead of making Gaza a sustainable, you know, place, an organized place, they can do it. They have the money, they have the options, and they have more legitimacy in interfering than the West world that never seem to understand, I would say, the Arab culture and the Arab sentiment.
But okay, Kobe, Gaza, but can I Gaza ask how realistic is that, you know, like UAE, Saudi are going to be willing to get on the back of an Israeli tank going to Gaza and basically say, oh, we're here to help rebuild? Well, I mean, is it really, I understand that right now there's no good option. Like where everything really only seems to be a bad option here. It's more of like what's actually a possible, like plausible option. Because it's a lot of these, you know, ideas are just, you know, kind of like Hail Marys, if you ask me.
Of course. But look, Israel's interest is not to control the Gaza Strip again. It's Israel's interest, okay, a need, actually. It's a necessity that Gaza will be free of gun zone. You know, that the Hamas will be disarmed. It doesn't make any sense that we went into a war. We are in this war for 2 months now, and we're going to go back, withdraw without getting Hamas. I can't say defeated, because honestly, it's a hard word, and you know, I don't see any point where we can say that we won, unless we're bringing the hostages back, the people that were abducted. By the way, they are not hostages. They are hostages. They're not. That's what I wanted to say. So Israel's interest is to bring back its people, hopefully safe and unarmed. And I gotta say that I can't trust Hamas. That, you know, we still have 137 people under Hamas's hands, and sadly speaking, I doubt if half of them are alive at the moment.
Hamas. It's also a big reason why the last humanitarian pause, the temporary ceasefire that was never meant to last, collapse was, I think it was, the issue was that, and correct me if I'm wrong, like Hamas couldn't find the hostages that they said were going to be released. They just said like they couldn't find them. Look, I don't know if they're dead or alive or alive, or they gave them off to other factions, or but they just they didn't know where they were.
Yeah, I got to tell you that it's, you know, I find it hard to believe that Hamas, I think that Hamas's, arguments sounds like Netanyahu in many cases. I don't know. When it's convenient for them, they don't know. But, you know, they know any little thing that passes the border from Egypt that is being smuggled through the tunnels, so they don't know where the hostages are. It seems weird to me. I think that they're playing a really cruel game here. I mean, Yahya Sinwar is known to be, you know, he knows Israeli society. He knows what triggers us. And he's playing with us at the moment. He has the leverage. He doesn't care.
He speaks fluent Hebrew, by the way, just for the viewers.
Yes.
He reads Hebrew newspapers.
Well, Yahya Sinwar was, you know, was the Hamas's, you know, one of Hamas's first activists in Gaza from 1988. He was actually sitting in prison in Israel for 22 years, executing four Palestinians who were suspected to be collaborating with Israeli intelligence. He didn't have any evidence. You know, they admitted after they were brutally mutilated. And then they were executed. But he sat in prison. And I'll tell you one more thing, by the way. In 2006, Israel saved his life. Did you hear about that?
He had a tumor. In the hospital.
Yeah, he had a tumor. And, you know, talking about the Red Cross and human rights, he was being treated in Israeli hospitals. But Yahya Sinwar knows Hebrew really well. He knows Israeli society really well. He's well educated, by the way. He has, I think it's a, he also has a master's degree from the Open University in Israel. So he's playing with us.
Yeah. And supposedly he met some of the hostages as well. He's underground in the tunnels in Gaza, and reports came out that he met with some of the hostages.
Yeah, but once again, that's a part of his play, you know, that he's coming to them, telling them, oh, you are safe when you are here with me. I will take care of you. And on the other hand, you have, for example, the Bivas family, a father, a mother, and two babies. Both of them has red hair, so they are quite distinct. That the only one that we actually know who was alive this week was the father, who was in a really bad shape, and they shot a video of him that I'm glad that the media didn't broadcast it. But they literally told him that his family is dead. Now, we don't know if they are dead or not, and if they were playing with him or not. Sadly speaking, I do believe in this case that they are dead, because so far Hamas has released, you know, the kids and the women, beside the soldiers, by the way, beside the, you know, the female soldiers. And, you know, but they were playing with him. Coming to tell somebody who's in captive, hey, listen, you know, your family is dead. It's quite brutal to do that. And also filming him while you are telling him that.
So it's going off of that, we talked about, you know, what Netanyahu and the government's, Israeli government's motives are right now for this war, which is essentially, I mean, it, you know, it's getting rid of Hamas, and we'll see what that looks like in a couple months and what that'll translate to. But going into what Hamas's motives are right now, they seem interested in a ceasefire, but, you know, at the same time, they are getting a good amount of support for, you know, for their war, for their, you know, you can put in quotes, resistance, however you want to see it. Like, what's their motive here? You know, are they willing to, seems like, you know, possibly willing to sacrifice the Gaza Strip to get support in the West Bank and possibly in the camps in Lebanon for another front later on down the line? For they looked like they wanted a regional conflict this round. They didn't get it. Maybe they're looking to build support in other areas to have that regional conflict in a couple of years. But like, what do you think their angle is right now?
I think that, look, as far as Hamas cares, the war can last. They know that Israel is having, you know, strong doubts on how we can enter the tunnels, because those tunnels have a lot of traps in them. Israel doesn't really know the path. It doesn't have the blueprints. We don't know how many terrorists there are down there. Where are the people abducted, you know, being held? So it's very complicated for Israel. Even if Israel will take the land itself, it will be a lot more complicated going down under. And as far as Hamas is concerned, they're already winning, because for them, you know, people in the West are seeing the horrific photos from Gaza showing, you know, people with no homes, all of the ruined buildings. And listen, the sentiment always goes to the weak. It always goes to the victim. And the people of Gaza are victims of Hamas. If Hamas wouldn't have attacked us on October 7th, Gaza wouldn't have looked like the way it looks now. But for them, nobody's blaming them in the world. When you look at it, you know, there is a growing sentiment to the people of Gaza, which I can totally get, because you see the horrible pictures, but nobody's asking themselves, how can it be that Hamas doesn't care about his own people?
Do you think, like, as an entity, they're going to survive this?
Yes. I mean, I think that eventually you cannot kill an idea. You can try and oppress it. You can kill its leaders. Listen, Israel has mastered in assassinating terrorists for years. It never ended terror when you think about it. The terrorists just found more vicious and more efficient ways to kill more Jews. So it can help for a really short, you know, in the short term. But in the long term, we need to figure out a political solution to that, not just a military solution. And I'm circling back to what I told you about the rocket attacks. Because when you think about it, if Israel would have, you know, reacted powerfully, you know, in the early 2000s, then maybe things would have looked different. I don't think that there is any country, especially in the West, when, you know, countries that cherish human rights and their civilians, would allow its population to live under rocket attacks. And, you know, we built the amazing system of, oh my God, of the Iron Dome. And in a way, we got, I would say, addicted to the Iron Dome. But I can tell you, on Friday, I went to shul with my father. And for about half an hour, we could have heard, you know, the Yirutim, the Iron Dome rockets that were fired at the Hamas rockets. Then on Motzei Shabbat, the entire center of Israel was under attack. I mean, and I'm talking all the way from Modi'in in the east, all around the Gush Dan area, which is the most condensed population in Israel. And it's a huge area. So you had almost 2 million people going down under, you know, in their mamads and the shelters. And it's insane. You cannot live like that. No country can let its people live like that. But the solution is definitely not just military. So, you know, we need to see what will the leaders choose. And if they decide to choose, you know, Tokyo, you need a brave leadership here. And I'm talking about a Ben-Gurion-sized leadership. And you don't see it in the horizon in either side, you know.
I know we talked about, you know, Netanyahu and his polling numbers last time and the kind of sentiment. We touched on it early on in this call as well. But you still see him surviving politically. You still see him carrying on as prime minister in spite of his extremely low approval numbers, in spite of the fact that it looked like his trial even started up again today. You still think he's going to chug along for another couple of years?
I don't know if for a couple of years, but everything that Netanyahu is doing is to serve his survival. When you look at how he's acting, his appearances, what he's saying, it's all first thing speaking to his base. You know that he haven't mentioned the people of the kibbutzim even once. He haven't met with the families of the abducted or the victims, you know, families of the victims, even once. You have, I think, one or two, you know, cabinet members. Moshe Arbel is one of them. At the moment, he's the minister of health. He used to be also the minister of interior affairs from Shas. And I think that he's the only, him and Chili Trooper now. Chili Trooper is another cabinet member. He's from Benny Gantz's party. But they are almost the only ones who's going from the coalition to meet with families. And it doesn't make any sense. If, you know, let's talk about what happened on November 30th. November 30th, there was a terror attack in Jerusalem early in the morning. Two terrorists started firing and they murdered two people. A civilian, okay, who's working for Shirut HaMedina, who's a public servant, took out a gun and fired and killed those two terrorists. A few minutes later, two reservists arrived and they were probably pumped up. They haven't checked, you know, his name was Yoval Doron Kestelman. They haven't checked the situation. They were all pumped up. And luckily, there was a video of what was happening there. I mean, I'm saying luckily because sadly speaking, he was literally executed. And what was happening there is that after he finished, you know, killing the terrorist, he threw away his gun. The two soldiers came out at him. He raised his shirt to show them that he is bearing no arms and he has no, a lot of times when you have terrorists, they may be having some explosives on them. It happened, by the way, you know, on October 7th. that a lot of the terrorists were carrying also bombs on them. That's why we needed special units to come and disarm a lot of bombs over there. And he was literally shouting at them, "I'm Israeli, don't shoot, I'm unarmed, okay?" And one of them shot him. Now, if you want me to refer it to something else, let's go back to 2016, March 2016, a soldier named Elor Azaria executed a dying terrorist in Hebron 11 or 16 minutes after he was already shot. And at that time, Elor Azaria was actually the chief of staff at that time, Gadi Eisenkot, and also the secretary, the minister of security, was Moshe Bogi Yaalon, came out and said, "Those are not, you know, the IDF's values. We are not shooting people who are unarmed and on the ground." Netanyahu backed them up for a short while. And right after, when he noticed that his base is turning against him, he called Elor Azaria's parents, telling them, you know, he made Elor Azaria Haben Shel Kulanu, everybody's child. And ever since, you know, the right wing is promoting this theory that every terrorist needs to be executed no matter what. And that's what happened. That's the result when you want to kill everybody at any cost, okay? You're shooting an unarmed person that in this case was actually an Israeli citizen, okay, who was actually a hero that 2 minutes, 5 minutes before was actually the one who neutralized the terrorists. And that's insane.
And it kind of goes back to what people like Ben-Gvir, who's the national security minister, it's basically his solution to everything is guns for everybody. So, I mean, you know, you're talking about the need for like a political settlement. And you're also talking about how on the horizon, things are just not looking good. And it's just a reality right now.
Look, the opposition in Israel is hardly exists. Yair Lapid is making voices from time to time, but you hardly hear his people in the media, and they are not going against the lack of policy of the government. This week, the coalition actually passed a budget that doesn't even care about the needs of the state. They were actually passing the budget that support all of the coalition's need, and all of the coalition agreements are being held accountable. And why is that? When you're asking me why I think that Netanyahu will survive, at least in the short run, Netanyahu is focused on his base and focused on his coalition. At the moment, he has Gantz in his coalition, but Gantz is there just like he was, you know, before, as a fig leaf, just to cover up for Netanyahu. So Netanyahu can continue doing politics while Gantz and Gallant are managing the war. And his people are saying, you know, Tali Gottlieb, one of the members of the Knesset from the Likud, said that the IDF spokesman is a leftist and promoting a non-right-wing narratives. Another member of the Likud, Nissim Vaturi, also one of the Uber Huchems, okay, was saying that Gallant and Gantz are kissing in the, you know, in the Kirya, in the headquarters. That's the level of what the Likud is doing. Instead of, you know, showing the people that they care, they literally ignore the people. You don't see them in the public space. You don't see them anywhere. The public sentiment is going stronger against them. When you're talking about the rallies, I got to tell you that the majority of Israelis are against protesting at the moment because they don't feel comfortable protesting while we have the soldiers in the front. Because you have soldiers that are right-wingers, soldiers that are left-wingers, they said, we need to be unified. But while you are saying that we need to be unified, the Likud is still doing politics, and the right wing is still doing politics. It doesn't go anywhere. And you need to ask yourself, what is more important? Holding Netanyahu as prime minister or taking care of Israel's problems? And there is no other way. And there is no other way to do it.
You do expect, you know, that there will be massive anti-government protests once the fighting dies down.
I think that once the fighting dies down, It's hard to predict. First thing, because I think that at this point, once we are done with Gaza, Israel has no choice but to go into a war with Lebanon, because that will actually be a defense war. Israel needs to make sure that Lebanon is clear of Hezbollah's weapons. How are we going to do it? I have no idea. I actually think that we need, you know, to demand from Lebanon throughout the international institutions to clear out Hezbollah. And knowing that they are unable to do that, we need to actively help them.
Okay, but what do you think the time frame for that is?
I think that as long as Netanyahu is there, it will never end.
And no, I'm saying, what do you, when do you think, you know, that because you know, a fight with Hezbollah would be much bigger than with Hamas. And I'm just curious, you know, what the
definitely,
time frame is. When do you think something like that would start?
Look, I think that, you know, at least with Hamas, it will take at least a couple of more weeks before, you know, the USA will tell us enough is enough and will start demanding Netanyahu to provide answers. As much as Biden is strongly supporting us, I don't think that, you know, in the long run, if he sees that Israel is, I can't say Israel, but Netanyahu is bullshitting him, then, you know, he will step up at one point and tell him enough is enough. And as far as Hezbollah, I think that it's more complicated. But before we're going to talk about Hezbollah, you're talking about the people on the streets. I think that once people are back and the fighting is over, knowing that Netanyahu is not going to go for election, because look, on legally, he has 3 more years to go with this coalition. And in 3 years, a lot can change. And that's what he's counting on. He has a strong, really firm coalition of 64 mandates that none of them actually wants to go to election. On the Likud hand, when we're talking about the polls, the Likud at the moment is the biggest party with 32 mandates. Okay? The polls are giving them between 18 to 20 mandates in total. That means that a third of them will be unemployed. They don't want to be unemployed. So they have no interest of going home. By the way, that is something that Gantz and Lapid should have taken in advantage. Because if they were doing politics to begin with, they would have tried to split the Likud and get that third of members of the Knesset from what we call the back seats, okay, to join Gideon Saar and Naftali Bennett. And if a third of the Likud would have, you know, would have quit the Likud, they could have formed a different party that can run for the following election. So if they would have done that, you could have had, you know, 66 men, women coalition, okay, of the opposition and the new members from the Likud, telling Netanyahu goodbye and setting up a new government. But they haven't tried doing that. And Netanyahu is more successful because he is doing politics all the time. He is actually meeting with those members of the Knesset that he doesn't trust. And he distrusts everybody. So he is meeting with everybody. To do politics and to make PR videos, he has a lot of time. I can tell you. You can see that if you're following his social media.
Yeah.
So that's where we stand. I got to tell you that it's really hard being here at this time. It's really hard seeing, you know, my people in such a, I would say in many cases, despair. When you hear the families, it's crazy to hear their experiences and what they've been going through. There are so many wrong things going on with the international institutions, the Red Cross, the United Nations, but also Israel. I mean, you know, if we don't know where the government is taking us, how can we blindly support it? But,
you know, a tough past, a tough present, and a tough future is what we're looking at. It seems, you know, what we're looking at.
Definitely.
Right now.
I mean, in many cases, I'm more pessimistic in the short term. In the long term, I'm very optimistic. But in the short term, I'm really concerned that at one point, the fact that Netanyahu is choosing to hold power will take Israel down to a civil war. at one point, because people are fed up.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see how the rest of Operation in Gaza comes out. And, you know, I'm sure I'll be back here as the operation is ongoing, but probably as well as when, you know, the anti-government protests pick back up, as that has always kind of been the point that you bring me on for. So, you know, having to juggle everything at the same time, it's always tough trying to figure out where to start, but there's always something going on.
There's always a lot to talk about.
Yeah.
Sadly speaking.
Yeah. So Kobe, you know, again, thank you for having me. And I look for always here and ready to speak to you further.
Definitely, Jeff. We'll meet again soon. And thank you everybody for joining us for another episode of Balagan. If you like the episode, please feel free to share it with others. It will be greatly appreciated. Thank you.